to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the fallout and the aftermath of the Trump-Benjamin Netanyahu White House meeting. A little later in the show, we're also going to be talking about the protest efforts today and the day without immigrant protest actions. But before we can move on. For years, the U.S. government has used depleted uranium bullets, although last year they said they wouldn't in the campaign against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Well, a new report has shown that this is actually a lie. We know now that in several strikes against IS in November of last year, just over 5,000 rounds of the munition were used. Depleted uranium is a byproduct of uranium enrichment and can be used in bullets to give them a special armor-piercing quality. Their first major use was in the Iraq War, the first Iraq War, I should say, under George H.W. Bush, which then later was what led to the first controversy over depleted uranium bullets, as many Iraqis stressed that there were serious health impacts on using this material, given the health risks that many of them had been exposed to over a course of about a decade, given the huge amount of depleted uranium bullets that was used. Actually, hundreds of thousands of rounds of the ammunition were fired off there in Iraq. While there's still some debate over the exact effects of depleted uranium, it clearly is not good for you. Most of the research that needs to be done has not been done. In many of the areas where it would have to be conducted, there are still active combat zones and it's difficult to get to. But that being said, there is evidence that depleted uranium is carcinogenic, and there is at least some evidence that workers handling the bullets over time were exposed to dangerous radiation. And certainly the general thrust of the evidence so far has been that depleted uranium could cause significant long-term harm in areas where it was used, which ostensibly is why the United States said they would not use it during the campaign against the Islamic State in the first place, given that it appears that to have had some negative effects unassailably. And that really, I mean, just the name itself implies its negative aspects. Obviously, their feeling was that the bad outweighed the good. However, the cost-benefit analysis appears to have now been reversed, with the United States using it on at least some occasions that we know of in the battle for the Islamic State. And it seems that as that battle continues to rage on, they will likely use the depleted uranium bullets more, given that their sort of forte is this vehicle-stopping ability that seems very relevant, given the strategy ISIS is using, which is very heavily on these large suicide truck bombs. It also means in areas where millions of people will be seeking to return, it's possible that tens of thousands of rounds of uranium-based munitions will have been used and will still be present. How that it could affect the soil and the water and the effects of radiation poisoning on people psychologically is unknown. However, the same was true of Agent Orange, little studied, and then when it was more heavily studied, the deep impacts for veterans of the war in Vietnam and hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians inside of Vietnam, which the people are still living with, then became very clear. So, in the quest by the United States to allegedly liberate Iraq and Syria from the ISIS, they could be leaving behind a poisoned landscape as deadly as any ruler in Raqqa. A new study released today by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities establishes that working-class whites have benefited the most from federal poverty reduction programs. And this is something some research had hinted at or an individual case already proved, although it's certainly still welcome. Among those who work on these issues that have some relationship to income inequality and poverty, they've been sort of using this meme for some time to explain why the racist pathologizing of so-called welfare programs is not just morally wrong, but factually incorrect. Now, this particular study details that in 2014, poverty reduction programs raised 6.2 million working-class whites out of poverty, which is more than the combined number of black and Latino working-class people lifted out of poverty during the same time, which is about 5.2 million. The percentages also express the same thing, so you know it's not just because there's like more white people in general. So looking specifically just at poor whites, about 44% of them were lifted out of poverty by poverty reduction programs, while looking at quote-unquote poor minorities, only 35% of those were lifted out of poverty by poverty reduction programs. For black people alone, that number was 43%. So either way you cut it, more white people are being helped by these programs than anyone else. And this is despite the fact there are actually higher percentages of black and Latino people living in poverty. Before any sort of program is factored in, about 24% of white people live in poverty. The same measure among black people is 43%, and among Latinos is 36%. So not only do white people benefit more from poverty reduction programs, they seem to be disproportionately benefiting. So not only does this report turn on its head the stereotypes about welfare, it actually shows that to some degree white privilege exists, even in the realm of poverty reduction. Over the past few days, we've been reporting to you on immigration-related issues, in particular the number of people being targeted for deportation by Donald Trump, despite the fact that he said he was only going to focus on quote-unquote criminal aliens first. As we've noted, the Trump-era regime at ICE appears to be returning to the more blunt approach of the Bush years. While President Obama deported a large number of people, the most of any president, he clearly was more for using a scalpel as opposed to a meat cleaver. Obama clearly wanted to end the perception that the government was indiscriminately raiding neighborhoods and jobs based on spurious tips and treating every Latino person as if they were some sort of illegal criminal alien, which was what Bush essentially was doing. And his approach to ICE President Bush was that basically more or less they were just raiding whole neighborhoods, whole jobs based on relative tips, with the whole purpose of clearly not just of deporting people, but creating a climate of fear inside the community itself and reducing immigration by proxy. People won't come if they were scared. Should be noted also, President Clinton tried to drive people into more dangerous routes, hoping that they wouldn't come if more people died. That didn't work. Neither did the Bush model. That's why Obama changed tax there. And Trump has now returned to this model. The latest evidence of this is a domestic violence victim in El Paso, Texas, who was arrested by ICE at the courthouse after filing a domestic violence complaint. And here's the real kicker. They did it based on a tip from her abuser. First and foremost, this is probably actually illegal. ICE is not allowed to act on the tip of an abuser if they don't have any other information. So perhaps they will retroactively try to produce some, but that almost certainly will be a cover-up, just like when they arrested the young man protected by DACA, then claimed it was because he was a gang member. More importantly, this could very easily prevent many women from coming forward with domestic violence claims who are undocumented, and certainly will supercharge abusers and most likely have them target undocumented women. What is even more infuriating is that, in fact, an undocumented woman being abused actually has various channels in which to gain documentation. The immigration system is crazy. It's terrible in many ways, but it does have a few provisions that can be used in cases like this. So now, in the irony of all tragic ironies, women will be afraid to come forward and report abuse, which is bad enough in and of itself. But they will be afraid because they fear being deported when having the bravery it takes to make such a complaint for anyone in the first place actually could be a lifeline in terms of normalizing their immigration status. Think about the three stories we've told you so far. A grandmother, a student, and a victim of domestic violence. These aren't violent, dangerous criminals. And it's more proof that the portrayal of immigrants as anything other than who they really are, human beings just trying to survive, is deeply offensive, rooted in bigotry, and flat out wrong. And those are today's talking points. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined to continue this conversation, although slightly shifting gears here, by Rania Kalik, who's a journalist and host of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast, so definitely check that out, and Richard Becker, who's the author of Palestine, Israel, and U.S. Empire. Thank you both so much for joining the show.
Great to be on with you, Eugene.
Thanks, Eugene.
So I guess I'll start with the big banner headline from the Trump-Netanyahu meeting that took place here yesterday, which was Trump, quote-unquote, stepping back from the idea of a two-state solution. And I mean, all right, fine, I guess I see where that's big news. But almost in a way, to me, it seemed like just kind of a normalization of the de facto one-state regime that exists more or less right now, as opposed to like a bold gambit for peace, which I think is how Trump is trying to – you know, whatever, present himself. So anyway, I don't know. Those were some of my sort of takeaway thoughts. I don't know what you guys were thinking. Rania, maybe I'll start with you here. Some of maybe your top line takeaways.
You know, I think you just said it really well. It really represents the official, I guess you could say, call it the official death of the two-state delusion. There hasn't been a two-state possibility for a long time now, but the administration, one after another, constantly pretends that there is, and it sort of keeps this pretend illusion of a two-state solution possible, and Israel just continues its permanent occupation and continues to steal more and more Palestinian land. So the fact that there's more talk about a one-state solution isn't a bad thing. I think it'll be interesting to see how people react, and you can see some of the reactions now, especially from liberal supporters of Israel in the U.S. They're losing their minds because this puts them in a real debacle, because if Israel-Palestine already is one state, like you said, it's the reality on the ground. It's just one state where millions of people, millions of Palestinians have no rights.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to have one state and you're a liberal supporter of Israel, then it comes down to, are you going to support liberal values, which are, you know, should be secular, democratic, one state, or are you going to support this indefinite apartheid system where millions of people have no rights? I think the other big takeaway, and we can get into this maybe a little bit later, but I think it's really interesting what the Trump administration is doing with Netanyahu, which is trying to bring like all of these different Sunni Arab countries, if you will, led by Saudi Arabia, on board on Israel's side against Iran. And I think that's a really dangerous development.
Yeah, no, certainly. I think that's one of the more interesting pieces, and I do want to get into that. Richard, let me get your thoughts on this little two-state step that they seem to have been doing there yesterday at the press conference, and anything else, banner, takeaway that stood out to you.
Well, I agree with what Rania's characterization and description of what's really happened here. I mean, Netanyahu has always only been for a Palestinian state when he's speaking really not to Israel, but to the United States. In the last election, he dropped the idea of a Palestinian state, and because he was fearful at that time of being outright winged, if you can believe that, but by other elements in the Israeli political structure. And then after the election, he went back and said, oh, no, I am for a Palestinian state. So, you know, you can't. Anything that Netanyahu says is like, you know, totally lacking in credibility. But the reality, as Rania said, has been one where the Palestinians really control virtually nothing. There is a Palestinian Authority based in Ramallah, which supposedly governs the West Bank, but really it's never had any power to prevent Israel from going in and arresting anyone at once, killing anyone at once, anywhere in the West Bank, including members of the Palestinian Legislative Council. And Gaza, on the other hand, is really, as has often been described, an open-air prison under the control of Israel, even though the Israeli forces have, at the present time, withdrawn from inside. And then for the 1948 borders of Israel, the Palestinians, who they like to call Israeli Arabs, but are certainly Palestinians, are second- or third-class citizens. So there's really one state apparatus that exists now, and what Trump has done by his statement, and the extreme right in Israel is extremely happy about this, as is the extreme right in the United States, has given the Israeli government the complete green light. Not that they haven't been able to do what they wanted to before, but just really to sign off on it and say, and his statement that he could live with either two states or one state, depending on what the Israelis and Palestinians choose, is another falsification. I mean, he hasn't talked to the Palestinians. There's no regard for the Palestinians at all. I don't think his government has had any high-level contact. I think Pompeo, the CIA director, went and met with Abbas. But aside from that, there's no regard at all on the part of the Trump administration for Palestinian aspirations. And that's been true in reality for many, many governments in the United States.
Indeed. Well, I think that's a great point. And it really makes me think of something else too, Rania, which is like, you know, for everything he's saying at the press conference about how open he is, I mean, if you look at who he's appointed as the ambassador, at least nominated to be the ambassador, and who his chief negotiator, Jared Kushner, is, it's like if you appoint two people who are basically Likudniks to the top positions of anyone who's going to be, you know, negotiating, it doesn't really inspire confidence that you in real life are actually going to just go with whatever.
Yeah, I mean, what you see happening right now with the people that are in charge of Israeli policy is that basically Netanyahu is in charge of Israeli policy in the U.S. Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, who's like 34 or something, a real estate developer with literally no experience whatsoever with foreign policy, let alone in the region, other than just going to Israel for, you know, for very far-right Zionist reasons. This is the person that gets to be in charge of negotiating peace. And this is a guy whose family foundation has donated money to illegal settlements, who's actually, Netanyahu slept in his bed when he was a teenager. So they've actually like been in bed. Like you say, politicians get in bed together, but these guys actually shared a bed once. Yeah. So this is, I mean, Netanyahu's been a figure that he's known since he was a kid. This is a very right-wing guy. And then there's David Friedman, the guy that Trump appointed to ambassador. And, you know, this is his, like, I think his lawyer, his real estate lawyer, who's also a far-right Zionist. And so it's true, there is this sort of alliance between the far-right in Israel, the far-right in the U.S. You kind of see it as well with, like, the far-right in other European countries. And the far-right in Israel couldn't be happier. I mean, they're all exciting. They're, like, excited and they're ecstatic about what happened yesterday. Naftali Bennett, the leader of the far-right Jewish Home Party and the education minister in Israel, was thrilled that Trump green-lighted this idea of one state, because this is something that they've wanted, to be able to just annex the entire West Bank. The interesting thing is that the Palestinian Authority, on the other hand, as Richard mentioned, the CIA director Mike Pompeo went to talk to people in the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank on Tuesday, I think it was, and they were pleading with him and trying to give him reasons to keep them in existence. The PA is basically dependent completely on funding from the West. It basically is a subcontractor for the occupation, and its entire existence is justified by the idea of a two-state solution, because that's who would be in power if there was a Palestinian state. Not that there ever will be. And so in order to justify their existence, one of the people there tried to, you know, plead with the CIA director that if they don't continue on the path of two states, then Iranian-backed extremists are going to take over the Palestinians or something along those lines. And so, yeah, there's like the PA is like trying to fight for its life now. But in the end, Palestinians have no power. And I mean, it's really, this is like bad, but it's in terms of how it's going to be for Palestinians, because Israel's going to be able to do whatever it wants, given the people who are running policy right now. But that said, there's like the only one silver lining is that at least we're not pretending that, you know, we're heading towards the two-state solution, because that was, I think, one of the biggest obstacles to actually having some sort of solution to this issue.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And I mean, I thought, you know, the very revealing thing, Richard, to me, to some degree, about the position of the PA was to see that yet again, you know, they have some sort of internal elections. It's Barghouti, who's in prison for like a million life sentences, is by far the most popular person amongst the Palestinians who are voting in these PLO elections. And he's the one who's the most critical of their current path, which in and of itself seems to kind of speak volumes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any question about that. The Palestinian Authority really has lost, I think, a great deal of credibility among the Palestinian population there. And I would just like to go back for a second to the people who Trump is working with on this. And Friedman and Kushner, Friedman is the president of American Friends of Beit El. Mm. And Kushner's family has supported them financially. Beit El is an extreme racist, violent settlement. I mean, that's really saying something among the settlements. But they're the ones who go out and beat and kill Palestinians, you know, attack their olive trees, you know, Palestinians who are anywhere around them. And then they really, it's really Adelson, the casino mogul who pours hundreds of millions of dollars into these settlements. And also extremely happy about this development is Ayelet Shaked, who along with Naftali Bennett is a leader of the Jewish Home Party, and she's this so-called justice minister in Israel who has called Palestinian children, all Palestinian children, little snakes. And these are the people who are, you know, all either very excited or in charge of making the policy that Trump stands behind. And in the face of that, what's the response going to be from the Palestinians? That's the big question. And I think, again, Rania is absolutely correct that the Palestinian Authority is entirely dependent on outside funding and is fighting to retain relevance in this situation. But I think that the big question, the real issue is, given the endorsement of the most extreme annexationist elements, the most extreme racist elements in the Israeli political structure and among the Israeli supporters in the United States, what will be the response from the Palestinian people who have fought for so many decades against great odds?
Indeed. Well, we're going to take a break on this point here, but we're going to come back with more with both of our guests on this issue here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the Trump-Netanyahu meeting yesterday, Israeli-Palestinian regional relations and everything along with that, with Richard Becker, who's the author of Palestine, Israel, and U.S. Empire, and Rania Kalik, who is a journalist, writes in a number of outlets, and also host or is a co-host of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast. And so, Rania, I'll start with you here, and I wanted to start this segment with something that you alluded to in the very beginning of our first segment, which was this sort of Iran thing. Now, of course, what the Trump administration has come out and said is that, well, we're going for a new outside-in strategy to try to work with the Arab states or whatever to find some solution. But the way it really sort of seems to be playing out to me is that what really is happening is they're using the cover of negotiating over Israel-Palestine to form a much more coherent anti-Iran front of nations in the region. I don't know what your thoughts are about that.
No, that's exactly what they're doing. And it's fascinating because this is Netanyahu's idea. This is what he's been kind of pushing for a long time. And now he's getting his way. And that is, you know, before it was that the way for Israel to achieve peace, you know, and conventional wisdom said this, was to make peace with the Palestinians. And then all of the, you know, surrounding Arab states would then make peace with Israel, right? The whole idea here is that you actually find a common cause with all these Arab states around you and focus on your common cause. And then that way you don't have to worry about, no one's going to care what you do to the Palestinians because you're going to be too busy, you know, countering whatever common cause you have. And so the common cause here is Iran. And they're totally just using, that's what Jared Kushner is going around doing. He's going to talk to the Jordanians. They're talking to the people in the UAE. They're talking to the Saudis. And they're like, look, you know, Israel hates the Iranians and the Shia. You guys hate the Iranians and the Shia. So screw the Palestinians. You guys, like, let's all get together and, you know, do something about Iran. And that's exciting. You know, that's exciting, the what they call the Sunni Arab states led by Saudi Arabia. And that's a huge concern because this is the biggest problem in the region right now, which is completely, I think, sadly overshadowed what's happening in Israel-Palestine, is this Sunni Shia sectarian tension that's really a fight between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And it's really damaging. And we've seen the destruction that it's caused in places like Syria. And it's also happening in Yemen, where, you know, Saudi Arabia is like just destroying Yemen with U.S. help under, and they're trying to say it's because the, you know, the Iranians are arming people in Yemen and they have to fight them, even though that's not exactly what's going on. So it's really, I mean, after the last 6 years of war in Syria, which has been, you know, which has been prolonged by the U.S. and the Gulf states, the Gulf Arab states, funding and arming these Sunni like extremist rebels, it's really concerning. I don't know what this is going to mean going, you know, down the line, but I hate making predictions on your show because they often come true. But I am concerned that, you know, when you think about the Golan, which is partly, you know, which one side is occupied by Israel, and on the other side of it, Hezbollah is fighting Al-Qaeda, which Israel has sort of has this like tacit alliance with in the Golan. There is a possibility that Israel could go to war against Hezbollah in Syria as a way to deal with Iran. And there's a lot of potential for a lot of these kinds of proxy wars to try and mess with Iran, and that, you know, that could do much, much more damage to the region than we've already seen.
And so, Richard, yeah, I want to turn to you and get some of your similar thoughts here. I mean, allegedly, this was the main topic, at least that Netanyahu was trying to bring into the meeting, was to keep it, try to keep it as focused as possible on, like, oh, let's fight Iran together and as much away as possible from any issue involving Palestine. And obviously, you know, certainly we know Saudi Arabia, UAE, what they've been trying to do. So your thoughts on this general situation?
Well, I think one thing that's worth noting is that the term Arab has somewhat disappeared from the narrative, the discourse in the United States and the mass media, and has been replaced by Sunni and Shia. And really, this is a product. This was not the case, if we, for those of us who remember back, it wasn't really the case before the U.S. war in Iraq. And because they couldn't suppress the Iraqi people sufficiently at the beginning, the U.S. almost immediately turned to the divide and conquer strategy of pitting one group against another and so forth. And now this has spread. So you have this discourse that is really the ultimate kind of divide and conquer discourse for the region. And the idea that there's something that the Palestinian people have some common interest with the rulers of Saudi Arabia or the, you know, these absolute monarchies in the Gulf is just absolutely ludicrous. I mean, the U.S. has aligned itself with the monarchies, with the most reactionary and undemocratic regimes in the world. And, you know, I would just like to add something to this, and that is that in terms of who's aligned with who, Trump, in his press conference with Netanyahu, pretends to be a friend of the Jewish people, you know, that his support for Israel is somehow motivated out of his compassion or something like that. Well, in the press conference yesterday, the last question that was asked by an Israeli reporter who asked him, what did he have to say about the fact that his campaign has whipped up, he didn't put it exactly that way, but basically this is what he's saying, whipped up anti-Semitism in the United States. And Trump gave the most incredible answer where he talked about how he'd won the Electoral College and, you know, the country was divided, but he was going to bring it together and he was going to bring love. And then, you know, his ultimate answer was that his daughter had converted to Judaism. He didn't exactly say that, but and that he had a son-in-law who was Jewish and three grandchildren who were Jewish. And I think it's important to point this out, that Zionism and Judaism are separate things altogether, and that being pro-Israel, the most anti-Semitic elements in the United States political structure ever since Israel was created have been pro-Israel, and that has not made a slightest dent in their anti-Semitism.
You know, that, I think that's a fantastic point as well, Rania. And I know you and I talked about this a little bit during the Democratic primary as well. I mean, it was just becoming so clear how amongst Jewish people in America, especially on a younger of a younger age, when, you know, Bernie sort of, I think, almost by accident got caught in that little kerfluffle around basically just saying, like, we should not agree with Netanyahu at all times, no matter what, which seemed pretty basic. But the fact that there is this huge furor over it, I think, revealed to some degree how, you know, sort of out of step the two things are starting, at least in America here, how out of step the two things are starting to become, and how more and more sort of Jewish American people, organizations like If Not Now, and other things sort of emerging seemingly out of nowhere, sort of saying like, whoa, wait a second, like, you know, these people are not speaking for us. I mean, it seems like an interesting new entrant in the political landscape here that was, you know, sort of to some degree revealed in that primary.
Oh, absolutely. And it's totally true about, I think, you know, I think what's happening right now is just making that much clearer, because the Israeli government is so right wing now. It's moved so far to the right. It has a lot of fascist elements in it at this point, that it's just, it's so much clearer to see the way that anti-Semites, like, I guess people on the far right from here to Europe, really do find a lot of common cause with the far right in Israel. And the Israelis are okay with that. I mean, in a lot of ways, Zionism is sort of dependent on anti-Semitism, because the whole idea is like Jews can't be normal, you know, living in other countries. They have to all like live in Israel. And anti-Semites love that idea. Right. So there is like a common, there's a common theme there. But, and I think that that's, you know, the majority of American Jews are liberal. The majority of American Jews vote, you know, who vote Democrat usually. They're one of the, I think, the most liberal demographics in the country. So there is, that's, it's becoming the choice that people kind of have to make. And a lot of younger people who are increasingly more liberal than their elders of all demographics, but a lot of younger Jews are just disgusted by what they see, because in the U.S. they support inclusiveness and they're against racism and they're against bigotry. And then you've got this country that, you know, with the leader Netanyahu saying that he represents the Jewish people and that he's just like oppressing Palestinians in the name of the Jewish people. And people, you know, young Jews are horrified by that. And they want nothing to do with it. And so that, I think that's actually going to be one of the biggest drivers probably of ending of at some point. I mean, I don't know when it's going to happen, but this is just unsustainable, the kind of support and alliance that we have with Israel. I mean, as soon as Trump isn't president anymore and there's somebody else in office whose base hates Israel, which is what you're going to see with the Democrats at some point, the policy is going to change. So I think one of the biggest drivers of that is probably going to be a huge dramatic shift in the American Jewish community on how they relate to Israel.
You know, I think that's a good point. It's sort of maybe stepping back a little bit and taking the underlying point in the context. And, you know, Richard, you were also very involved in the first anti-apartheid movement with South Africa. And, you know, I often make this point, which sort of historically is always interesting to me, is that, you know, the apartheid regime in South Africa sort of in a similar way turned extremely hard to the right in the 80s. Reagan comes in as the president, essentially tries to sort of help them renormalize to some degree, stabilize the situation there, obviously tries to use Angola and the Cuban intervention as a wedge. And all that completely fails, and it essentially, you know, it collapses under its own weight. And I mean, obviously, this is one of those issues that has, you know, everyone is saying there is going to be some ultimate resolution. But it does seem to me somewhat notable, and in a similar way, how, you know, even sort of the, if you can call it moderate, I hate to even call it, but let's say the more moderated elements of the Zionist political structure seem to be totally ships at sea now. Everything seems to be controlled by the hard right, the politics, every movement. It has sort of a striking parallel to me that maybe in some ways that's a sign of the weakness of their argument and their project, not of the strength.
Well, I don't think that there's any question that the moderate elements in Israel are increasingly marginalized, and that the government has gone further and further to the right. And as Rania mentioned, has outright fascist elements in it. I think one of the things that's worth noting is that after the end of the apartheid system, there was a delegation, there have been a number of delegations from South Africa, high-level delegations that went to the Palestine and came back and said, you know, we've never imagined how horrible it is there. Mm. That it was terrible for us, and it's even more terrible for the Palestinians. And, you know, that, of course, doesn't get reported at all in the mainstream media. But one of the fundamental differences, I think, is that the South Africa apartheid regime and the capitalist class there was dependent on black labor for the super exploited black labor, and wasn't trying, much of the black population was had no employment. But the objective, the main thing is the objective of the South African apartheid regime was not to drive the population out, the indigenous population. The objective of another apartheid state in Israel certainly is one, is to drive the population out. Their aim is to get rid of as much of the Palestinian population as possible. So that's the two apartheid systems with somewhat different objectives, but of course both based on the complete injustice for the people, the indigenous people there. And the state of Israel, I think that this is the trajectory that has grown. This is the long-term trajectory of Zionism, is the removal of all of the Palestinian people if they could do it. So far, they haven't been able to. I don't think they'll be able to. I think the Palestinians are going to fight back against it. But that certainly is what the perspective is.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. And, you know, slightly shifting gears here, Rania, but I know certainly we've had you on the show before. You've done some in-country reporting from Syria. You've been following the issue. I mean, what are your expectations, if any? I mean, this seems like this is relatively hard to predict, about sort of where Israel is going to project in the Syrian conflict. I mean, it seems so far that they've been relatively happy to see, like, complete and total chaos and utter destruction inside of Syria, which makes sense since that was one of their prime adversaries. But now with this potential for maybe Trump, who seems to be getting closer to Netanyahu, also saying he's going to try to combine with Russia against ISIS, I mean, where does that kind of leave Israel in that mix? I mean, do they intervene more, less, kind of keep the status quo? I mean, I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, Israel's interests in Syria are twofold. One is the Golan Heights, trying to basically keep it forever by saying, look, the Syrian conflict is so chaotic that now, and that's actually something Netanyahu brought up yesterday to Trump. And he's talked to Obama about this before too, is the idea that, oh, there's all these people killing each other across the border, so we should just get to keep the Golan forever and settle on it and remove the Arabs there. So that's one interest. The other interest, I mean, one of the main interests that Israel had in Syria in the first place was the fact that the Syrian government was not conducive to Israeli interests, and it was allowing the Iranians to arm Hezbollah through Syria. And that's like Israel's biggest nemesis are Iran and Hezbollah. And so for Israel, they've actually, throughout the Syrian conflict, had this alliance with the really extremist rebel elements like Nusra on the border, helping them against Hezbollah in the Golan, which has been fighting them. And so where does that leave Israel in respect to Syria? I think now that Trump's in charge, the bigger issue is, let's go after Iran. I don't know what that means for Syria. It's very, very, I mean, it's still early to tell because Trump hasn't been very clear about what his policy or what he wants in Syria, what he wants the U.S. to do there. So it's still unclear. But the fact of the matter is that the rhetoric, the anti-Iran rhetoric, and basically the kind of anti-Iran conspiracists that Trump has surrounding him in his administration are a really worrying trend. And they basically are just like the Netanyahu style Israelis who just, they want to attack Iran. And so I don't know like how that's going to affect Syria, but I think in the broader context of the region, if the U.S. attacked Iran or if Israel did, it would be absolutely disastrous. And there's no telling like what kind of chaos would happen afterwards, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very, very good point there. Richard, I'm curious, similar things. I mean, the day after Mike Flynn was resigned or fired or whatever, you know, the news story is this today about what really happened with him. The day after it happened, Aaron David Miller was up in the New York Times, prominent State Department guy, as some people may or may not know, friend of Israel, if you will. Either way, you know, puts up this article in the New York Times op-ed, and he's lamenting Flynn leaving because Flynn was so good on, you know, Iran. And by good, he meant like he was really all about attacking Iran. And it just was sort of interesting to me that, I don't know, the whole thing was interesting to me. So curious your general thoughts about sort of, you know, where Israel may try to move in relationship to this, the Syria conflict.
Well, I think that everybody who's paying attention has noted that there might be a certain lack of sanity inside of the Trump administration, but they could really prove that by provoking a war with Iran. I mean, that would be so extremely dangerous to the world. And, you know, Iran is a much, much larger country than Iraq, which the U.S. has not been able to gain control over. And what is this? We're 14 years after the invasion of Iraq. Iran is a large country. It doesn't have the kind of weaponry, of course, that the United States has or Israel has, meaning nuclear weapons and other weapons, advanced weapons. But if there was an attack on Iran, it could set in motion uncontrollable events. It would certainly mean that the Straits of Hormuz, which is a major oil shipment point, would be closed down. And it would really, so this is what Netanyahu has been wanting. This is what he has wanted for a long time when he did the kind of silly stuff like going with his bomb picture to the United Nations. But he's pushed it and pushed it and pushed it, not because they really think that Iran is going to attack Israel right now, but because Israel and the U.S. and Israel share this objective. But Israel in particular wants to really diminish any country in the region which is powerful and independent. And that's been the U.S. objective ever since World War II, when it became the dominant power in the Middle East. So it's very possible, and that this could go forward as a project. And but if it does, and there was a big debate about this in the Bush administration before they pulled back from actually going to war. But as I say, if they do that, it really can set in motion the kind of alliances and events that could spiral out of control.
Absolutely. Well, I think that is a very good point to end on. We're going to have to leave it there before we go to our next segment. You were listening to Richard Becker, who's the author of Palestine, Israel, and U.S. Empire, so you can pick that up. And Rania Kolick, who is the host of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast, which you should listen to, and also a writer who writes at a number of different outlets about this and many other issues. And like I mentioned, we are going to take a break here, but we're going to be back with more on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik here in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the pretty major pro-immigration action that's been taking place in lots of different ways all across the country today in the United States, called the Day Without Immigrants. And we're joined by Teo Reyes, who's a research director at the Restaurant Opportunities Center, to talk about this. Teo, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So I wanted to first start, for those who maybe don't have any context, what is the Day Without Immigrants? Are they protests, strikes, people just staying home or whatever? Just give us a sense of what's happening and why it came together this way.
Sure. So the Day Without an Immigrant, it's all of those things effectively. You have workers who have gone off the job. You know, we've seen a tremendous proliferation of attacks against immigrants from the administration, right? We've seen the ban against Muslims, and we've seen recently associated with that a growing number of raids against immigrant communities. And instead of responding with fear, although there is a lot of fear, people are responding with action as well.
Yeah, no, of course. And so, you know, it's interesting because this has a little history, the idea of a day without immigrants. I believe it was 2006, May 1st, where millions of people came out. And obviously, the issue at that time was the Sensenbrenner Bill and things that were happening. And Sensenbrenner Bill sort of died right there on the operating table because of these massive protests. The sort of political conversation shifted to quote-unquote bipartisan immigration reform. Nothing happened, but nevertheless, I think it showed the power of people to move things legislatively, even outside of just the ballot box. And so even though the situation here is so bleak, I mean, is there some hope in your mind that sort of these like large manifestations of things happening, and I think most people know this is happening today, can really sort of affect the status quo here?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a lot of employers who shut down voluntarily in support of their immigrant workforce, right? Certainly restaurants here in D.C., restaurants in Philadelphia, restaurants in other cities that said, okay, we're going to close down doors because workers were interested in supporting the Stay Without an Immigrant campaign. But then a lot of other employers are, you know, had to close down and they're not, and have effectively offered tacit support. So they weren't happy that they had to close their doors, but they're not really seeking retaliation.
Yeah.
I was on the street. I was, you know, marching with a group here in D.C. earlier today, and there was a lot of support from the community. People were coming out, you know, both from businesses and from their homes to support the march as it was going by. So I think there's certainly a lot of community support. You know, what it leads to, we'll have to see.
Mm-hmm, indeed. And I wonder if there's also just an aspect to this, too, of just the importance of a show of strength. I mean, I know a lot of people I've talked to in different communities around the country have been thinking, how can they, in addition to pushing the legislative process, really take an active role in resisting deportation? Some people even looking to operate as an underground railroad. Some people just in general wanting to do something in solidarity. The movement of people saying they want their city to maintain its status as a sanctuary city, and so on and so forth. So also just to some degree, maybe whatever Trump is going to do, whatever Congress is going to do, to see that, you know, the depth and the breadth of support there really is, and that whatever they do, they better take this into account because there will be resistance.
That's absolutely true. It's crucial that people reach out to the representatives, let them know that they support their immigrants in their communities. We know, like you mentioned, after the marches in 2001 and while we had all these different efforts for the comprehensive immigration bill, there was a huge outpouring of calls from the right opposing any type of comprehensive immigration reform. And so now that we see the result in such stark relief, what it might mean to actually actively attack immigrant communities, people need to respond, say they're opposed to that, that they value the diversity in their communities, they value what immigrants bring. You know, they're crucial to a wide variety of industries. You know, our economy is really dependent on them. And it's untenable to just seek to exploit the immigrants and not really try to bring them into the community. And people need to speak up about that.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. And I also wonder, I mean, to what extent does it also speak to the need to sort of grow and expand the political movement, if you will? I mean, we just had the first Somali American legislator elected this year in the country in Minneapolis, which I thought was fantastic and really a great counterpoint to them, you know, trying to then put the ban on people coming from Somalia. Obviously, we've seen a large proliferation of Latino folks getting involved in politics at all different levels and all the different political parties. I mean, how important is it, too, that the decisions that are made on this at the end of the day, that we really stress they aren't all just made by, you know, the preponderance of Congress, which is like, in fact, all of them now are millionaires, but preponderance, old, rich, white men. I mean, that's even on the Democratic side, seems like that's also an issue in and of itself. I mean, even if you're more conservative, you know, a lot of those people, I think we saw, were the ones who were willing to sort of step out there and say they're for comprehensive immigration reform, because sort of like just being a black person, there's certain sort of red lines where you can sort of see the reality of the situation. So the importance of expanding, I guess, the just sort of social issue movement into also a political movement.
Yeah, I think tied to that is the fact that we can't give certain industries a pass, right? Like the National Restaurant Association, which in the past was supportive of comprehensive immigration reform, now they want to be in good graces with the administration, or have really remained silent in the face of these attacks against immigrants and have supported a streamlined e-verify system. But at the same time, they want to be able to continue to exploit the immigrant workforce, like you said. So we really need to hold them accountable. We need to support the employers who are saying, look, we want people to be treated with dignity and with respect. And we need to really be calling into account large corporations or large interests such as the National Restaurant Association that want to be able to really play both sides of this issue, not to take a stand. But you know, at this point, the country is demanding a stand. So you have to choose where you're going to stand on this.
No, for sure. And certainly, I know that's one of the things that ROC has done well over the years, having the High Road Employer Program, essentially just sort of people saying and stating restaurant owners that what their values are aren't in comport with some of what their industry claims to do. And I mean, I don't know if you think this could be a pivot to that, but it seems to me that, you know, I like to assume the best in people, although perhaps sometimes I'm naive, that maybe there are a lot of businesses that maybe didn't think a lot about this, but then saw that not only the Trump administration may have affected them personally, they may view themselves as more liberal, more progressive, and then seeing their own workers being so unified and wanting to come out, that perhaps some of those folks who may have been a little bit more resistant to raising the tip minimum wage and different things like that might start to see how these issues are really working in tandem.
That's absolutely the case. That's something that we just saw play out actually in Maine. Just yesterday, Andrew Puzder, who was the nominee for the Department of Labor, had to withdraw his nomination because of the widespread opposition from around the country. You know, we spoke with CKE workers, workers at Hardee's and Carl's Jr. who just spoke about the, you know, the terrible sexual harassment, about the terrible wage theft, et cetera, that they faced in their the workplace. And the National Restaurant Association was really pushing Puzder forward as someone that would push their interests and really push down labor conditions around the country. And what happened, they got the head of the Maine Restaurant Association to send a letter to Senator Collins, and all of a sudden restaurant owners heard about this and started calling in saying, we don't support this. We don't support you sending this letter. We don't want to be associated with the support for this administration and these things that it's calling for. So I think you definitely see these issues start to propagate in a very different way. And I think we can start to turn around the conversation, like you said, on minimum wage, on eliminating the tip minimum wage, which federally is still $2.13 an hour. You know, it's way past time to get past that.
Indeed. And I know that there potentially will be a ballot initiative on that in Washington, D.C. coming up sometime soon, which hopefully will be good news. And I'm glad you raised that point, too, because the narrative around the Puzder thing, to me, has been very interesting the way it played out. Is now the media is reporting it as like, oh, well, it was just a bunch of Republicans who you know, didn't like him because he had one time supported a guest worker program. And that to me seemed transparently false. I mean, the guy's thing was the hearing was rescheduled 5 different times and no Republicans were saying anything. It was only people who were supporting workers' rights were, I mean, rightfully so, burning this guy up that he was so terrible. And it seems to me that this is maybe a bigger win and we shouldn't allow this sort of Johnny-come-lately explanation that it was about guest worker programs to forget the fact that there was a pretty, I mean, after DeVos, I think Puzder was the guy who had the most people against him because, I mean, his record was just shockingly abysmal for someone nominated for this position.
Oh, absolutely. And there was opposition around the country. There were hundreds of letters that were sent to newspapers. People called in, certainly to their representatives, telling them they opposed his nomination. There were polls that were conducted in Alaska and Maine, and the majority of both states significantly opposed Puzder. You had groups, you know, we surveyed, we spoke with about 900 workers, completed surveys with close to 600 of them who told us about these problems at their restaurants that they faced. And this really led to widespread opposition around the country, right? You saw massive mobilizations by Fight for 15. And that really laid the groundwork for the Republicans to be able to use these other excuses to go ahead and justify why they would vote no, because they were getting a beat up at home around this as well.
Yeah, for sure. I guess they just couldn't come out and say that. I thought about this last night, and I think this is an interesting fact of how when it really comes to workers' rights issues, it's a lot of these Republicans that are out of step with their own base. I mean, we've seen a lot of red states, or not a lot, but a good number, raise the minimum wage. I mean, we really have seen, I think, I hate to say almost bipartisan because it's not political party base. It's just like maybe pro-human, a real rise in people willing to support, regardless of who they vote for at the top of the ticket or whatever, to these kind of pro-worker policies when it's put at them sort of directly at the ballot box, at a ballot measure in particular.
Politicians need to rethink how it is that they approach voters. They need to stop being afraid to tackle difficult issues. Like you said, when they're presented with concrete economic questions, voters repeatedly vote in support of raising the minimum wage. And there's no reason why you couldn't have a really progressive, aggressively progressive agenda that would also win at the ballot box.
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly the case, and I think that the one thing we'll have to see now too is where this this next gentleman, Mr. Alexander Acosta, seems to fall when he gets in there. I don't know if you know anything about this guy that they've nominated. We're trying to gather some information as we came into the show. It seems to be more or less par for the course for Republicans, which means probably not great on workers' rights issues. But you know, who knows? Perhaps he'll be better. But I don't know if you guys have any initial thoughts about him.
No, our thoughts is just that he needs to go have a thorough vetting to ensure that, you know, he is going to actually uphold the mission of the Department of Labor and not seek to undermine it.
Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to just get some of a snapshot of, especially since labor issues are so huge in immigrant rights. I mean, they're so, I think, intimately connected. I actually believe that the Fight for 15 was able to get a big fill up from the fact that there had been a lot of movement work done amongst immigrant communities that are heavily rooted there. And that was a big piece to why that could be so successful so quickly. I just feel like this story isn't told enough. But in the last set of elections, in the past few years, it seems like on issues, especially the tip minimum wage and the Fight for 15, that we are making progress, sort of creeping progress perhaps, but it really is kind of slowly sweeping the nation at a state level that we're starting to get movement on these issues. So I was hoping you could talk about that a little bit too.
Absolutely. So, you know, we've seen two states move towards a path to a $15 minimum wage, California and New York, multiple cities. We have seen both the state of Maine and City of Flagstaff, Arizona, eliminate the sub-minimum wage, the tip minimum wage, which is always significantly lower than the full minimum wage, which is ridiculous because tipped workers live, experience higher rates of poverty than the rest of the workforce. And I think what we need to be focusing on now is, okay, we've been presented with this tremendous obstacle at the level of the federal government, but looking at just the opposition, the level of opposition, and I would say joyous opposition to this administration, we cannot lose sight of the opportunities at the local level to advance a progressive, you know, progressive causes. Absolutely. I think this is the moment to move that forward, especially if you have an administration that seeks to polarize people in a way where you're actually able to broaden the coalition of support for a progressive agenda at the local and state level.
No, I think that's a great point. I did an interview with the Washington Post a couple of days ago, and they asked me that exact point. It's what I thought about the connection between the national and local. And I said, well, to me, it's been fantastic because all these people who maybe cared about politics but just weren't engaged are now thinking, I got to find some way somehow to get engaged, and are very open to that. And I'm curious in the work you guys have been doing, and we've asked this to a lot of people on the show, it's been pretty universal that just about all the issues, the local, the state, the federal, on the progressive side of the ledger, people are seeing more and more people come out and want to be a part of it. And that even though people are angry about Trump, they sort of their own volition recognize it's not just about Trump and really want to engage across the board.
I think that is the case. I think you see a lot of people who would tend to, in general, have a very progressive consciousness, who are all of a sudden seeking to take action on almost on a daily basis, right, which you would not see before. Before, it was sort of just like par for the course every day. You know, you just go through your regular routine. People are engaged. They're engaged with the issues across the spectrum, not just, a particular question associated with the administration, but just across the board. I think that's entirely true. But we actually want to take that one step further. We know that there's a lot of restaurant workers who voted for Trump and who are going to be experiencing buyer's remorse, and we have to be able to welcoming, bring them back in, because they're going to be crucial to advancing a progressive agenda at the local level as well. And so we can't lose sight of that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And I mean, I wonder, like, what are some of the key points of dialogue, do you think, for that conversation? Because I think sometimes the emotions are high, the rhetoric gets heated, and people on both sides, and, you know, sometimes you may not be as far apart as you think. I mean, what are some of those points of dialogue that you all are trying to create in your base, regardless of how people voted in November, to bring folks together?
It's exactly what we've already discussed. The issue of the minimum wage, people are supportive of it. And, you know, we can point out that these people that are being promoted, such as Puzder, are opposed to it, opposed to, you know, a basic economic advancement. And talk about healthcare. This is an issue that's going to become more and more pertinent as people actually see the effects of losing the healthcare that they've achieved over the past couple of years. That becomes a very strong way to really build a conversation and bring people together.
Yeah, I think the healthcare one, I mean, it's actually interesting to see even the Republicans now, the people from the states that expanded Medicaid, basically going back to the rest of these people and saying, like, look, you cannot get rid of this. I mean, we can't just bring millions of people in, give them healthcare, and then kick them off one day and do nothing. And it does seem like there is kind of a sleeping giant issue there that could heavily affect. I mean, in the same way, I thought it was underplayed how the insurance premiums went up, helped Trump. I think in the same way, eliminating Medicaid, which obviously Republicans love to do, seems like that also is going to hurt him in a big way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope we're able to take this interest and work to a system that's better. Like you mentioned, we don't want to see rising premiums. We want to have a system that is expansive for all, you know, single payer if possible. And I don't think we should put that aside as a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, it's the strangest paradox I've never understood. And I don't think there is a good answer because it's still strange. Is I think the best thing for businesses that could ever happen would be single payer healthcare. If you didn't have to have one-off plans that cost businesses tons of money or lose the best workers because you can't offer healthcare or leave or whatever, that this would be a game changer. And so part of me thinks that maybe reopening this conversation is the opportunity to at least raise some of those points again.
Yeah, some of it has to do with the role of money in politics, certainly the pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry. Same thing as we face, you know, like basic things such as raising the subminimum wage, which is $2.13 an hour at the federal level. It hasn't gone up because of the power of the National Restaurant Association. And, you know, we see the same opposition to healthcare because of the pharmaceutical insurance companies.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's a really – I'm going to start saying that, the subminimum wage instead of the tip minimum wage, because it is funny how language – can change everything in terms of how people conceive things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. And also, and I can give all the credit in the world for Saru Jamin from Rock for giving a talk where I saw this, the roots in Reconstruction and the re-enslavement of Black people of the emergence of tips in America. Really, really unbelievable, really shocking. And I hope people, you know, look at that, check that out, see that, find the work of Rock United that shows people that issue, because I think so much of the intersections that happen here in terms of who is working in these industries, who's not working in these industries, why they are that way, why we have tips, really rejiggers the conversation in a way that I think is extraordinarily helpful. But I want to thank you so much, Teo, for coming in and doing this interview. And Teo Reyes, the research director at Rock United, please, please check out their work. And if you're a restaurant worker, work with them. That is going to do it for us here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to all our guests today. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. As always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.